Today's topic is the third in a series of three topics dealing with what I think are the main issues that we are contending with as human beings. A couple of weeks ago, I dealt with what I thought was the main issue number three, which had to do with our tendency to bond and reject, that is, grab or take what we want, and to push away or even disempower or kill what we don't want. The following week was main issue number two, which I thought had to do with our beliefs about taking action. I think it's pretty obvious that what we want to do as physical human beings is to cause desirable results. We want to take action and produce desirable results. But because we become wrapped around impulsive actions that take us forward and also doubts and fears about those actions, which can produce paralyzing inaction of procrastination, we have to deal with that particular issue. And today, I want to deal with what I believe to be the main issue number one, and that is our fear of feedback from ourselves for what we have done and not done, what we have done to others, and what we have not done for others. Now, that is number one, is the main issue number one. It may sound like a little odd to us. Me? I'm afraid of what I say to me? And that's where we go from here. Who reviews and catalogs our every action? Usually before, during, and after that action. Who has the complete inventory of comparison material that we've accumulated over our lives? Every event, every experience, every thought, every feeling. Who talks to us constantly throughout the day, every day? Who debates in our heads the course of action? Even the minute things like getting out of bed, getting a job, exercising, asking for a raise, asserting ourselves. What are we going to eat for breakfast or lunch or dinner? About the debate about going to bed at a reasonable hour, and on and on and on. Who is on both sides of the procrastination equation, urging us to take action and urging us not to take action because of the fears related to those actions? And the answer to these questions is we do. Now, for some of you, you may have already gone to the all-knowing, all-judging, all-condemning, all-being, seeing, omnipresent God, which is what we're terrorized with as children. But the one that terrorizes us in reality over the course of our lives is us. Let's say that somebody is unkind in speaking to us, and they intentionally say something that's hurtful. For instance, they want to call us a name, and they say, "You're an X." And you can fill in that X any way you want. Now, normally we would perceive this environmental signal, right? It's a sound, or if we're able to see them, it's a visual input as well. We can see the expression on their face. We could tell whether they're joking or not, and the level of malice or fun they're having with this. We translate this environmental signal, we give it meaning, and then we draw conclusions about the person who said it, the statement itself, the words in it, the environment in which it was said, that is the context, you know, whether we happen to be on the baseball field or, in somebody's home or where. And then we draw, most importantly, conclusions about ourselves on the basis of this environmental signal. Now, it took me about 1 second, maybe certainly less than 2 seconds, to say that example, "You are an X." That spoken energy exchange experience last less than 2 seconds. However, our digesting, our translating, our ruminating about it, our thinking about it, our churning it over and over again, as we repeat that process, sometimes endlessly, it can go on for minutes, it can go on for hours, literally, for some people, those experiences go on for years. And we can get stuck, and we could see it like this. We get stuck in a painful thought loop. We're doing it. We're doing it. I think everybody is familiar with this particular problem. Said another way, we were hurt by that dart of energy that lasted less than 2 seconds, but then we take that statement, we take that dart, we take that knife, we take that energy, and we re-stab ourselves with it over and over and over again as we're trying to make sense out of it. We could have concluded that the speaker, before they made that hurtful statement, they were feeling threatened, and this was their way of trying to disempower the threat, us. And as a result of that, they went into the state of rejection, trying to protect themselves. We could have understood and appreciated that they were speaking from their level of consciousness. We could have been loving. We could have been compassionate about it, knowing that not only do they, but we all do the same thing. That is, we all express and experience life that is a direct reflection of our own consciousnesses. But what we do is typically interpret things that people say as being real and being about us. So we legitimize, we empower that statement, you are an X. And then what we do is, having accepted that, now we make that threat more tangible, denser, more powerful, and now we have to either fight it or run away from it, because we have made it real. And if we fight or run, what we've done is now entered the state of rejection as well. Instead of asking the divine for help healing our new hurt and helping the speaker heal their fears and their hurts, we literally make them denser by feeding energy into them. Said another way, with this image that I've been using as a result of these thought processes, is we spin the tornado vortex, that's us, we spin that energy around by battling it and making the problems even more intense than they were in the first time. We had a problem that lasted less than 2 seconds, and now it lasts indefinitely until we deal with it. I think this one concept, making things worse by rejecting, explains why forgiveness is such a powerful healing strategy. When we choose forgiveness, when we choose compassion, when we choose another viewpoint other than rejection, we literally feed energy into bonding instead of feeding it into rejecting. And that allows for a movement of energy that is healing not only of us, but others that are involved in that. We fear feedback from ourselves and others because it's rejecting. We learn rejecting. We learn it from our parents, our siblings, our peers, even as children, our clergy, our teachers, and those people who we believe are our friends. We see other people practice the habit of rejecting. We find ourselves on the receiving end of rejection. And we learn how to use rejection as a weapon, not only of defense to protect ourselves, but as offense, as to hurt or disempower other people. And over the course of this training program, we learn to be afraid of rejection. Some of our earliest religious training is about rejection. And that is the Garden of Eden scene, when God rejects Adam and Eve, according to the standard traditional Christian training, because of what they did. We recognize God's rejecting, our parents are rejecting. Okay, I got it. We've mislearned a lot of stuff. If our mothers were rejecting overall toward us when we were in utero, and when we were born and in our early years, we're going to tend to have the habit of displaying that same voice of rejection toward ourselves unless we correct it. If we were exposed to rejection directed toward other people when we were at home, over dinner, or any place else that we would have found ourselves, and others are being degraded or denigrated or criticized or judged for their ethnicity, their race, their religion, their occupation, their looks, their intelligence, the way they speak, the language that they speak, etc., we're going to tend to be rejecting in those same ways. We can learn a lesson from the old United States Western movies. The phrase, "He who lives by the gun dies by the gun." In other cultures around the world, that statement may have been more commonly, "He who lives by the sword dies by the sword." Now it is obvious in life that he who lives by rejection dies by rejection. Rejection blocks the flow of life force. It impedes our connection to divine consciousness. And we've been taught to reject what we don't like. Instead of accepting its differences and marveling in its differences, we tend to reject it. We do it in certain areas, particularly with regards to people or political beliefs or religious beliefs, but we don't do it in a lot of other areas. I happen to be looking at the window as I'm speaking now, and I'm seeing a variety of plant life. And we think variety of plant life is particularly exciting. We think the colors of the flowers are very interesting, intriguing, and beautiful. We like that. We appreciate that. We bond with that. I'm looking at lemon trees. I happen to have a lemon tree. And if I had banana tree, if I had any other kind of fruit tree, I would be amazed by the variety. And palm trees and this and that and all kinds of stuff. But when it comes to people, that variety is not seen as a positive thing in a lot of ways, and we tend to reject variety instead. But because we've been taught to do that, thinking if we reject what is a little bit different from us, we'll be safer, is so far from the truth. Even before we were born, when our mothers rejected what they didn't like, we were imprinted with their behaviors. There's a book that I'm fascinated with, recently published, called Origins, and it's about how the 9 months in utero shape the rest of our lives. The development of the uterus, by the time it's 2 months old, has already started to develop tastes in food, what it's going to like and not like, what it will consider normal and desirable as food, and what it will tend to reject, what it will bond with. So you just go, wow, this is already happening because of what energies are being provided to us. And parents, as they talk in our environment, and our mothers, as they talk and think and feel, are providing those energetic diets for us that shape the way we process information. Their feedback shapes our tendency toward information processing. When we watched other people reject other people, or us, we were imprinted with those behaviors. Because our human minds are so active, we've got a lot of internal dialogue. A lot of people say, I can't stop this monkey chatter. That my mind is going a mile a minute. Well, I'm thinking this, thinking that, thinking this. And I'm in place A, I'm thinking of B. And if I'm in B, I'm thinking of A or some other place. If I'm doing X, I should be doing Y. And I'm thinking, if I'm at work, I'm thinking of being on vacation. If I'm on vacation, I'm thinking of being at work. Our minds are unbelievably active with this internal dialogue. Because there are so many demands to take action, do this, do that, rules, what we should be doing, and all of these other things that have been imprinted upon us, we have a lot of dialogue that goes on about the specific actions that are needed to meet all these particular demands. I should sit, stand up, I should lay down, I should go to bed, I should work harder, I should, you know, be kinder, I should focus on this, I should focus on that, and all of this stuff. And because we have so much stored information about not making mistakes, not committing sins, not being wrong, not being at fault, not being to blame, we've got a lot of cautionary counter-intentional internal dialogue that says, be careful, take action, go all the way, be careful, don't go too fast, don't count your eggs, your chickens before they're hatched, and so we got all of this stuff going on. That imperative to take action is like us putting a foot on the gas pedal, pressing hard. And we also have fears about taking action, and this is like pressing very hard with the other foot on the brake pedal. And you can just imagine the internal stress of the engine in the vehicle, that's us, from these two counter impulses. For those of us who've had a lot of negative inputs about actions over the course of our lives, and anybody who's been a small child in a normal home where there's a lot of no, don't touch that, don't, bad boy, bad girl, don't do that, we've all had that. So if we've had that kind of an experience and didn't grow up in a really permissive environment, we're going to have, number one, a lot of counter intention. We're going to, every time we want to take something, do something, think of something, we're going to have the negative opposite pop up. We're also going to have, as a second point, a lot of recorded dialogue that we're going to use. It's almost like accessing an MP3 recording, or the old days, a cassette recording, and we're going to play that recorded dialogue that we would have heard from these people. These people being our mothers, or our fathers, or siblings, or priests, or ministers, or peers, or whomever rejected us. We hit the play button, and we'll play it back to ourselves. We will fear the pain that we're afraid that we will cause ourselves when we deliver negative feedback to ourselves. We're going to give ourselves negative feedback for actions that we take, or we intend to take, or we've already taken, or we should have taken. If we have developed that pattern based upon our training of using negative feedback to ourselves as a prod to happiness, it's like hitting yourself with a hammer to make yourself happier. Not going to really work. On the surface, we can imitate the myth of God becoming angry with Adam and Eve. I believe it's a myth. If God is all loving, a child or a couple of children that, quotes, misbehave, end quotes, especially when it's apparent there was a really negative influence in their environment, like the neighborhood bad boy, it doesn't make any sense that God would punish those children. But if we imitate that myth of God becoming angry with Adam and Eve and punishing them, and then we've adopted this idea that's been sold that we are being punished because of their sin. And so now we replicate God's behavior toward ourselves. We self-punish. This fear of our own feedback traps us. It traps us, particularly if we use it as the main factor in our decisions to act or not act. And it's like, oh, okay, I want to do X. I'm gonna beat myself up if I don't do that perfectly, if I don't do that flawlessly, if I don't do it so quickly, so this way, so that way. And we hold ourselves to impossible standards of perfection that it's like, this is going to be too painful. What I'm going to do to myself during and after this action is going to be so painful, I can't take action. That is going to be a problem for us. It's kind of like the farmer who is sowing fear-filled thoughts into the field of action. What is that going to get us? I think it only can give us a harvest of fear and pain. On the other hand, we can notice that one line of action is liable to result in pain, either immediately or based upon the feedback that we give ourselves. We can instead search for the best next action. That's a specific concept, best next action. I like to capitalize those three words, best next action, because if we can recognize that if this action aligns with our goal, we're looking for the best next action that does align with our goal, whatever it is we're trying to accomplish. And I would say, generally speaking, we could define our goal as to be the cause of desirable effects. We want the results that we cause to be desirable. Number one, to us, because we're the ones that are really the ultimate judge of this, and we're going to use that result as either the source of relief or pleasure or pain. The clearer our goals and intentions, literally, it becomes easier to discern the better action, and the less we're going to be affected by our fears and our unbeliefs. So if we're in doubt, clarifying our goals, what we want to accomplish, more than how we want to accomplish it, but what we want to accomplish, we're going to make our lives a lot easier for ourselves, and we're going to reduce that potential for negative feedback from ourselves. Everybody knows this expression, I am my own worst enemy. What does that mean? How do we describe this act of being our own enemy? And sometimes we use it when we see the result, but that's not where our being an enemy comes from. It's not the result, it's the feedback. We act like our enemies when we reject ourselves. We act like our enemies when we attack ourselves. That's how we become our own worst enemies. We're not being our own worst enemies when we're self-accepting or when we're loving. It's not, I had too much self-acceptance, I had too much self-love, I had too many loving people in my environment that made me feel safe and secure. That's not happening. And I dare say there's not a single person in prison in the United States, and we got a bunch of people in our prison system, who had adequate love and acceptance and was taught self-love and self-acceptance and how to help other people experience love and self-acceptance. There's not one person in a prison with those feelings. There's a big difference between rejecting a possible course of action and rejecting ourselves taking that possible course of action. We're going to make choices. What to have for dinner? Do we have food A or food B? And we choose one is similar to rejecting the other. But we can do that without enmity. We can do that without hate. We can do that without negative vibrations. And we can look at those choices as just a choice. Taking action is taking action. Not taking action is not taking action, period. But disempowering ourselves with self-talk, negative feedback, because we did or didn't take action, that's when we become self-destructive. I mentioned that self-talk was taught to us. It was modeled for us. It was demonstrated to us. What to say, when to say it, how to say it, why to say it, where to say it, etc., were all demonstrated to us and practiced on us by other people, which we then turned around and started applying to ourselves, and we started practicing it on ourselves. I think it's very easy to make this connection that the degree of negative self-talk and negative talk overall, that is about other people and conditions and situations, is discernible from looking at that person's life conditions. If we think of self-talk as cheerleading plus seed planting that empowers or disempowers us and creates a harvest of like energy, we can tell what a person practices in their self-talk and seed planting. We can look at the conditions in our own lives in regards to any of the 12 worlds that I speak about, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, physically, family, career, financial, social, leisure, community, political, and maintenance, and say, let me look at the conditions in there, and let me look at how I think, feel, and talk, and believe about me in that particular arena of my life. If we think of self-talk as a vibrational nourishment process, and I think we ought to, because we're not just doing a nothing kind of thing. We are feeding ourselves. If we think of it as a vibrational nourishment process, I think it's easy to leap to. Happiness is a symptom of our feeding ourselves through self-talk. Happiness is a symptom of our self-talk, and conversely, so is unhappiness. I mentioned you could look at somebody else's life or our own and see what area or world we're the happiest in. I think it's safe to assume that our self-talk with regard to that area is the most positive. As an example, my mother was the mother of 7 children. She was also a registered nurse. My father was the father of 7 children, and he was also an attorney. My mother was happiest when she was working as a nurse. She much preferred that role, that world, that arena, than being a mother, cook, housekeeper, nurse for 7 children and a husband. Relative to staying at home, going to work for my mother was like going on vacation. And I think she got the best feelings from that, not only from her self-talk, but what she was open to delivering to her patients and accepting from them. My father hated being a lawyer. He was happiest when he was explaining or teaching or clarifying ideas or concepts for people. Besides being intelligent mentally and linguistically, my father was physically intelligent. He could use his hands to fix a car, cut his kids' hair. And when you got 7 kids, learning how to cut hair is probably a good financial thing. So he knew how to do that, and he did an excellent job at it. He knew how to work with wood using all kinds of tools that we used to have in our cellar. He could butcher meat, chicken, and other kinds of meat, and all kinds of things with his hands. And any one of those activities, from fixing a car to cutting kids' hair to working with wood to preparing meat for a meal, gave him more joy than his career in law did. The amount of negative self-talk that having so many kids, 7 children, 2 people trying to manage them who are not good managers, that's really a problem. Those 7 children and the responsibilities of all of those, emotional and physical and financial responsibilities, provoked negative self-talk in my mother, and the law career and all those children responsibilities for my father, they provoked negative self-talk that ultimately sabotaged their overall happiness. And there's a ripple effect when a person has got negative self-talk, and it ripples out to the people closest, in this case, to the rest of us in the family. So our happiness was disturbed by their self-talk. And frankly, it's where we learned how to be negatively oriented toward our own behaviors. We knew how to be critical of our own actions and inactions. There has to be another way to interpret the feedback and the fear of feedback to ourselves, from ourselves. Otherwise, we would just have a permanent, threatening boogeyman that never could be healed, could never be cured, could never be effectively dealt with. That can't be the way it is. As Christ said in the Christ Returns, reveals startling truth. Both bonding and rejecting are necessary elements in human existence. Without them, there could be no individualization. We wouldn't have individual bodies. We wouldn't have individual items nearby. We wouldn't have chairs and computers. All this stuff that it seems to be individual wouldn't exist without rejecting. We need it in order to separate from the chair that we were sitting on or the floor that I'm standing on or any other individualized patterns in our environment. And so rejecting in this context is a good thing. If bonding is the movement of energy patterns toward one another, rejecting is the impulse of separation. Need to have the two of them, those two things in the vortex, those two forces that are in some sort of balance in a vortex or that tornado sort of image that I've described previously. I can see it as the gas pedal is a tool to move us toward something, and the brake pedal is a tool to stop that movement. None of us wants a car without a braking mechanism, because in a case like that, we wouldn't be able to control that bonding. We use rejecting to control our bonding. We use bonding to control our rejecting. We don't want to be driving down the street with no braking mechanism and bonding with trees and pedestrians and other cars and whomever else or whatever else is in the way. We wouldn't want that. If we can decide to be separate from other people and things without falling into the ego trap of offering negative, low vibrations to do that, we're going to be so much better off. We can maintain distance without animosity. And that is a lesson lots of us need to learn. Since we reap what we sow, there's a real advantage to being able to offer energies of bonding and rejecting that are not damaging. Because whatever we offer, they're going to come back to us. They are the seeds that we're planting, and we will have a harvest. So in a case like this, obviously we want those vibrations to be most beneficial to us and to others. It seems to me that self-rejection has to be one of the worst things we could do to ourselves. It's contrary to a loving and accepting God. Unfortunately, that's not the God we were taught about. Most of us are taught that God is going to punish us for what we did or didn't do. If we do this, we're going to be punished. If we don't do this, we're going to be punished. And that was the driving force to a lot of our behaviors. And when we had misbehaviors, we pretty much were resigned to doom of hell and damnation and those kind of experiences. If we do that, we can also learn this misbehavior of preemptively punishing ourselves through our thoughts, our talk, our emotions, and our actions. I actually remember as a child talking to God about punishment, almost like a lawyer pleading his case, saying, God, because I'm suffering so much, because I'm so miserable, I'm so unhappy, I would like this to be considered as time served. So when you're considering whether to send me to hell, I would like you to look at how much I've suffered and kind of cut me some slack. I actually did this as a young boy. That's weird and sad that some kid would be taught that he would need to start doing that, choosing suffering, so later on Judgment Day, he would be able to play that, oh, suffering previously suffered. Do I get out of jail sooner? Sad and weird. Nothing and no one can really keep us from the buffet table of the truth of existence that's been provided and described by Christ in the letters, except ourselves. If we speak to ourselves with something other than the voice of love, which is what we were created out of, we're lying. If we're offering anything other than love to other people, we're lying. If we participate in supporting anything other than to listen to the truth of existence, we're listening to wrong advice, and we're going in the wrong direction. That is the very long way to get to where we want to go. Today I realized that when I look at the three main issues that I've been talking about, that one of the common themes in all three of these issues is that human beings, believe that each of us is the only ones we rely on to meet our own needs. And when other people don't do it, we get angry at them, we reject them, we try to bond with them to manipulate them into doing it. But basically, it's we have to meet our needs, and we have to cajole or manipulate or beg or plead or force or demand other people to meet our needs. We believe that we have to rely on our own limited resources, our intellect, our physical strength, our physical energy, or say our aptitudes in order to get our needs met. And we also misbelieve that we have to judge ourselves for our humanness and our failings. Concisely said, we cause our three main issues by mistakenly thinking that we are alone without support. And here we are, trying to succeed in a sea of anxiety, right? Watch 6 o'clock news if you don't know what I'm speaking of. The sea of anxiety caused by us not knowing the principles of a happy life. And you could look at all the ads that have occurred over this holiday season telling you how to be happy. What car, what whiskey, what diamonds, what gifts, and what toys, and what junk, and what to do, and where to go in order to be happy. So we got all of these pushes and pulls by other people's manipulations, their own anxieties, their neediness, their expectations that we're the deliverers of their happiness, and it's not going to work. It doesn't work. We cause our three issues by not understanding that we're not alone. We think we're alone, and that's the beginning of our isolation. If we really set our minds to understanding, and this is basically a quote from Jesus from the book, understanding and experience the reality behind and within all things. And this is how he defines reality, using the words that we use. We use that reality behind and within all things. We use the word God, Allah, Jehovah, Yahweh, infinite intelligence, divine mind, divine consciousness, the Tao, supreme being, and a whole bunch of other words. If we understand and experience that, we would transform ourselves, our bodies, our lives, our families, and our worlds. When we, from a business standpoint, I like this little model, when we think or feel or take actions, if our life, our individual life, is a sole proprietorship, I have to do it all on myself, everything is resting on my shoulders, almost like that myth of Atlas holding up the world. He's holding up the world. We fall into false thinking. That leads to trouble. We can realize and practice the habit of turning to our silent, senior, most powerful partner, divine consciousness. And if we do, we can heal our fear-based grabbing and pushing, that greed and that unkindness that we deliver, grabbing, and then pushing and slamming and even destroying others. We can know that we're supported in our decision-making and our action-taking. We can speak lovingly, as our partner does, to ourselves, to encourage ourselves to become more aware of ourselves, become more aware of the truth of existence, become more aware of the reality that has given us individual form and which maintains and sustains us. I thought, as I was writing this earlier, how much time have I ever spent looking at a scratch on my finger, and over the course of my life I have a bunch of them, as we all have, and looking at that scratch and trying to understand the power, capital P, that was going to actually make this scratch heal. You know what? I doubt if it was even a nanosecond. I just looked at it, it's going to heal. But I never gave thought. I didn't focus on and question and wonder and want to have a relationship to the divine power that was actually behind this design that was going to work in my on that scratch. I think we're missing a great opportunity there. Let's look at our families. Not only our family of origin, but our own families, if we've had them when we became adults. I think that, for me personally, and perhaps this is true for you as well, that the self-talk that hurts me most is invariably related to my not being effective at helping another person's growth. My siblings, my parents, my own children, my own spouses, not nourishing them when I was presented with an opportunity to help them with encouraging words that would sustain them, or another viewpoint, or listening. Or I missed the chance to help them heal by letting them release whatever hurtful energies they've taken in, either by falling on their knees or scraping themselves, or being hurt in their interactions and energy exchange experiences with other people, by not providing for them adequately, by not providing for their survival, or not realizing or modeling the reality of the rhythms of natural cycles to help them understand there's high tide and low tide, there's day, there's night. And these normal rhythms, these normal seasons, these normal cycles are something that we can bank on, we can count on, and know that they're going to sustain us. But I missed opportunities to explain or demonstrate my knowingness of that. Or I missed opportunities of showing an understanding of law and order that says that life cooperates with us, helping us to stay in balance. And when we look at those missed opportunities, it's a great opportunity today to do two things. Number one, to go into forgiveness, to be self-accepting and loving, and consider that a part of the human experience, and to commit to being an instrument to allow divine consciousness to work in us, for us, and through us, as everybody around us is seeking to come into contact, whether they know it or not, with these nine items of the truth of existence. Yesterday was Christmas. Today can be the birth of our new awareness as we seek to understand and experience God's presence within and around us. I would like to end the service with this modified prayer from the book Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth. I pluralize this. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know that it is your will that we should be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. It is so. Thank you. Amen.